News, sports, weather from Dr. Bill Williams, traffic info from Kane, and one of the Gulf Coast's most familiar voices. It's Mobile Mornings with Dan Brennan and Dalton Arwig.
Good morning from Dan and Dalton. Sean is in for Dalton this morning. Thanks again, Sean. Hey, double no duty. So what's a midday Mobile look like today? Have you got a little... lineup?
A blockbuster lineup.
Okay.
So I've got things to say.
Please.
Now, to join the midday show. We'll talk a little bit of presidential politics. Also, locally, Representative Matt Simpson coming in. One of the things we're going to talk about is a pre-filed bill about not requiring saltwater fishing licenses to take part in jubilees. It's something I talked about on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Mike Ward and I did on Saturday morning, and the story's out about came out last week about this bill. Now, Representative Simpson had talked about this before with me, and he's going to join me. I imagine we'll talk about that, and then a lot of other items coming up for the legislative session. So,
well, help me understand this. So, he's talking about statewide legislation.
Yeah,
but
it only apply to strip of land where jubilees happen.
Yeah,
although there are some rare jubilees happen on the west side of the bay, but it's a rare thing.
Mm-hmm.
We went through this story before earlier this summer. I know a lot of people disagree that they think you should be able to harvest.
At will?
Within the limits. There are some people who say you should be able to get everything because they think they're all going to die. They don't during Jubilee. They don't die. Once the hypoxia, once the oxygen daylight gets up, they come back. They come to, and the oxygen's in the water, and the critters can swim off. But the question is, should you? So I think most people, there are some people that are like, I should take whatever I want. But there, most people I've talked to, they believe the limits should be in place. But you shouldn't have to have a fishing license, to take part in a jubilee. My unpopular opinion is you should. So we'll debate some of that today.
And as far as when you live on the Eastern Shore, say you live in Point Clear, Fairhope, your land extends to the beach.
There's a high water mark thing. I mean, people can walk the.
I mean, do you own that part of the land? Once the water stops and you have maybe...
Well, it's the high water mark, I think, is where,
Most
people have bulkheads there or whatever.
Okay. All right.
So as they walk down and they're, to that bulkhead or whatever, it's just like the beaches. Remember this during COVID when they shut the beaches down?
Yeah.
And I was like, what? The outside, separate, but the state had the right to do that because the state owns... That for, even if you have private property on the beach, the state owns the public. We the people own that intertidal zone or whatever I think the term is for it.
Wasn't Florida wide open, and they were getting hammered over it? Like their beaches were was there ever a time of?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure
the first summer. I mean, I remember Florida being more and getting killed on the news on the national news for.
People being outside,
well,
getting vitamin D,
being near each other, on the beach. But was
silly,
Dolphin Island was closed?
No, it was. Yeah, when the governor put that in, that was what I'm getting to. This is we've kind of gone off a tangent, but just to say that intertidal zone belongs to the people. You don't own unless you have a bulkhead. They can't be up in your yard or whatever. Like, but you have that area. It's the same thing. If you had on a house on the beach, other than the bay. You own private property, but people can still walk down the beach because that's public. Now, they can't walk up in your yard.
Yeah.
They can, but they're not supposed to.
Yeah, that's a problem I'm never going to have, but thanks for straightening that out. The Dan Brennan's future beachfront property, that's on hold.
Yeah, it's mine too.
10 minutes after 8 o'clock. Let me run something by here real quick, Sean, too, and I hate that you're answering all my queries here this morning.
Okay.
But you remember when Mayorkas came out last week and said, we've got enough money for what's in front of us here, FEMA. We've got enough FEMA money for what we're dealing with here with Helene, but we don't have money for future storms, which looks, here's your future storm about to happen in Florida. So he had that to say, but there is a new controversy. And it looks like, let me find out real quick where I'm at with this story. It's not, I apologize, it's the Inspector General now saying that they've got money. Inspector General released a report saying that FEMA is sitting on at least $8.3 billion in untapped, unspent funds. On October 2nd, Mayorkas said, we're expecting another hurricane hitting. We do not have the funds for that. This guy's saying we do have the funds. This new controversy is surfacing as Milton, of course, has now become Category 5. Analysts say FEMA cannot tap unspent appropriations from long ago crisis, so the money sits frozen as you have, you know, all the damage up in North Carolina. So is the money, is it money they can tap into or not? I don't quite get it. It's $8.3 billion. Again, this is the Inspector General of the DHS, which I guess is a step below Mayorkas or so. But he's saying we've got $8.3 billion, but analysts say FEMA cannot tap into that money.
Well, it seems like if that's the rule, then Congress could undo that.
Okay.
Okay, because they are about appropriations. They hold the purse strings. You know, we see this at a state level with earmarking. You know, we will go into session and be debating the budget, and we're talking about really in the general fund maybe 7% of the budget under debate, 93% in Alabama's earmarked.
Yes,
which is silly because sometimes you have needs other places versus.
Sure.
So I think that's got to be a semantic argument.
Okay.
I think if they really want to do it, exactly like I said before we went to the news too, and Congressman Carl pointed this out yesterday when we were in that discussion, and you can go back and check out the podcast and listen to that full conversation. But he said, by the way, too, as we're going down the list of places there are money or they've spent money, not just on the, you know, the housing, the illegal immigrants. He said, Sean, do you know how much money we spent in September on COVID? And he gave me the number. I said, oh, is that September 2022 or 21? He said, no, of 24. And it's $4 billion was spent on COVID-19 aid in the month of September of this year, which was the most of any month since 2023. It must have been for the kits or something like that. But it's, you know, you look at this, they spent. So look at the breakdown here. I'm looking at like an Excel sheet of spending here. It's this is the Disaster Relief Fund monthly obligations for fiscal year 2024 from the federal government. And line items are initial fiscal year 2024 spend planned estimates. And then they list like California wildfires, Oregon wildfires, these things that are still, they're still paying on from the past. And then it said COVID-19 monthly actual estimated obligations. So this is 2024. September, $4 billion in spending.
I don't quite get that, Sean. I don't know.
And I mean, it may be for test kits, outreach. I don't know. It doesn't have a breakdown here beyond that main line item of what it is. But there's money out there. That it's just how you've allocated the money. And Congressman Carl said, we fully funded FEMA. This is not an issue. They do have the money to pay for this. So. And once again, we're going to see this on top of, once again, we have the challenges we're talking about. And I'm going to tell you right now, the number of people, there's so many affected from Helene, but even though the swath of this Milton is going to be smaller, it's a lot denser population. You go through Central Florida.
Absolutely. Right?
It's going to be a lot of people affected there. And you look at Tampa, Orlando, that I-4 corridor out to the east coast of Florida there's a lot of people there. That are going to be hurting.
This is way different than what we just saw. I mean, this is, and I'm pretty familiar with that area because my sister living down there. But it is. They've talked about 1.5 million Tampa Bay.
It's 3 million.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
3.2 million in the metro. So and then how about Orlando? So there it is.
And also there was a conversation between the press secretary, and I guess it was Ducey with Fox, talking about what we were just talking about those funds. And that got a little contentious as well. Do we want to go to the phone lines here?
We came for. I do want to say, by the way, Corinne Jean-Pierre has been offered a new gig, too.
Really?
This is over the, I guess this will be the swan song of Corinne Jean-Pierre. What is it? They offered a position like a, let's see, I don't think it's a pay increase, but another position with the Biden administration going forward. Forget what it is. I'll get to that in a second. But yeah, Corinne Jean-Pierre, I don't know if that means she's going to be doing double duty or she's not going to be press secretary anymore. I don't care what party. Who wants to be the press secretary? I guess I'm too much of an individual thinker to do that for any party. But, yeah, okay, Corinne Jean-Pierre is to serve as senior advisor to Biden during the final 3 months in office.
Huh.
Says despite internal concern about Jean-Pierre's performance, which resulted in an unsuccessful attempt to coax her to step aside, the new title likely does not include a pay raise, as Jean-Pierre, 50, already earns $180,000 per year, the same as current senior advisor.
So that job's not worth the $180,000, the aggravation.
No, imagine the ulcers.
No kidding. All right, let's see what's going on here. Who are we talking to?
This is Jay, isn't it?
Jay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. How are you doing today?
Doing fine, Jay. What's going on?
Well, I'd like to thank you guys for your show. I really enjoy it, but y'all hit a nerve with me earlier.
Sure.
The state of Alabama, when they shut down those beaches, committed a crime against humanity. It was insane. It was crazy. It was just pure out stupid, and we need to call it what it is. People have a right to go outside and enjoy their life, period. My body, my choice. And if we're going to live that philosophy, we need to mean that philosophy. And we need to conduct a hearing on the COVID virus and how badly it was conducted at the local, the state, and the national level. It was one of the biggest disasters we have ever had in this country. It showed the weak-mindedness of our government and our people in allowing this to occur. It should never, ever happen again. We claim to be Americans. We claim to love freedom, but we had the opportunity to fight for it, and eventually we did. We need to never, ever let that happen again. There are great crimes committed against humanity at times. That was one of them. And, Sean, thank you for bringing that up today and reminding us that we didn't have the right to walk the beaches. It was taken from us. And we have to fight every day to keep our freedom.
There we go, Jay.
Appreciate you, Jay.
Put you down as undecided on that.
Yeah, he's just walking the fence
the beach thing. I mean, that was, but people that came up because of private property.
Yes,
but the state does own to the mean high tide, the intertidal zone there.
Mm-hmm.
How we went from Jubilees to COVID. Hey, that's the kind of show we run here.
It's 18 after 8 o'clock on FM Talk 106.5. If you missed what Dr. Bill had to say earlier today about Milton, we've got that around the corner. Good morning from Dan and Dalton, FM Talk 106.5. Sean is in for Dalton this morning.
Howdy.
Got our eye on what's going on with Milton. Looks like it's still out in the Gulf of Mexico, but it's... They're almost sure the strength of it. It's a 5 now. It may not be a 5 when it gets to the coastline. That's good. Take any good news we can get. But it might be a 3 or a very strong 3 or a 4. So none of that is really good news. Some of the officials are putting out some pretty dire messages, like the mayor of Tampa. Her name is Jane Castor. She says this is going to be an event like you've never seen before, and talks about all the different things that you're going to be dealing with if you decide, especially in Tampa, to stay, which she does not recommend. This is Jane Castor.
Helene was mostly a water event for us. This is going to be wind, water, storm surge, rain, you name it. It's going to bring everything towards our community.
All right, What do you think, Sean? What do you think? What are we going to be talking about in 2 days when the storm hits?
I mean, if it's staying like it is, the tree damage is going to be something. Obviously, storm surge. Start looking in Tampa, and you know, I sent you some stuff this morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at some topography maps of, you know, and it's like I get frustrated around here when national media will assume that topography is the same everywhere. Like Katrina or other storms are like, oh, this could flood. And you're like, well, we're not South Louisiana. We're not even as flat as the Mississippi coast, right? I mean,
that's right.
Yeah, but you've got, you've got the Ecor Rouge, right? You have the bluffs at Montrose that are some of the, I think, the highest on the coast until you get to Maine.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that bluff is true. We have some different topography, and Florida does to some degree. Actually, if you'll be driving north of Tampa, there's a little kind of, say, mountains. I think they're probably
hilly.
I think they're sand ridges, but mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely some topo there. So certain parts of Tampa, 15 feet of storm surge, it's going to be a big deal. And there's so many so many people live on the water. I mean, that's one of the great things living there, right? Yeah. Having your house on the water, they're going to be, you get 15 feet of storm surge. It's going to be a big time problem. I think the highest point in Tampa is 48 feet above sea level. A lot of it's around 20, 22, I look. So those areas won't get inundated by storm surge. Obviously, other areas will, mm-hmm. big time. And then in addition to that, I think the you start talking about, say it's a Category 3 coming in. Frederick was a 3.
Yeah,
y'all remember? I was a kid.
I didn't realize that.
I was a kid, but I remember what the pine trees looked like here in our fair city after that. So, I mean, the tree damage, and then if this pours the rain like it's going to, do you remember the inland flooding they get on the peninsula there? Mm-hmm. It's a massive flooding inland as you go to places like Orlando and those places.
Here's what Dr. Bill had to say as we talked to him earlier today.
Yeah, yesterday the storm reached an incredible 180 mile per hour sustained wind, which meant that it had gusts probably around 200 miles per hour. A very small storm, and it remains that way, but it's going to change. And during the night, it underwent what we call an eye wall replacement cycle. And the eye became extremely small, just a few miles in diameter. And this happens when the storm gets extremely strong, although it can happen at other times, but most likely when they're very strong. And as a result, the smaller eye collapses and a newer one forms at a larger diameter. And during that process, the top winds will drop down. And so it dropped from 180 miles per hour to 155, which is the way it is right now. 155, which makes it a Category 4, but right on the edge of being a Category 5. Now, will it rebuild again? It looks like it will. That usually happens after the new eye forms at a larger diameter. It starts to become smaller and smaller. The storm increases in intensity. I don't think it'll get back up to 180, but it looks like by this afternoon it may get up to around 165. It's right now just north of the Yucatan Peninsula, very close to it, and it's beginning to turn more to the northeast, and that's going to be the track here for the next couple of days, or at least for the rest of today and tomorrow, and it will continue as a major hurricane. Once it gets up closer to the Florida Peninsula, it'll undergo some wind shear. And that's going to slow it down a bit, not in forward speed, but certainly in wind velocity. But the likely target now is Tampa, and that will occur tomorrow night. And it will be at least a Category 3, maybe a 4. It's going to push a lot of water, particularly it was up to 165 mile per hour winds. It will be pushing a lot of water, although it may drop down in intensity, perhaps to 145 or 140. That is still a very strong hurricane. And if it goes into Tampa, Tampa Bay will receive double-digit storm surge, possibly as high as 15 feet. And that will occur to the south also of Tampa, down along the coast, and many areas, even as far as Fort Myers, could get up around a 10-foot storm surge.
There you go. That's what Dr. Bill had to say this morning. It doesn't seem as the morning went along much had really changed at all. We'll see, you know, maybe during the day if there's some sort of shift, or if he just wants to jump on with you again.
Yeah, you'll probably have him on at 12:30.
Okay.
Yeah, normally he joins me to give an update.
All right, we're going to go from one potential disaster to one real disaster right now up in North Carolina. Pete Rehm, who you know from this radio station, is in North Carolina right now, and I believe is in the Asheville area.
Yeah, I saw some of his pictures over the weekend on Facebook. Unbelievable damage.
Yeah, unreal. So he'll let us know what's going on up there and what he sees in terms of FEMA, Red Cross, and that kind of thing. All coming up. Good morning from Dan and Sean. It's in for Dalton this morning, 8:35 on FM Talk 106.5. I've been going to more Pee Wee football games lately. I don't. It's just it turns in. It's kind of a treat. But, yeah, a friend of mine, you know, I've got friends who were Zach's age, and now they've got their kids.
Right.
So I was a coach back in the day when they were little kids. So it's just fun to watch. Oh, okay, now I'll watch your kid play.
And you see, you know, going through this, my youngest is 14 now, mm-hmm. I got a 19, but to go watch kids' sports, there's those kids that are like phenoms, already into it, they know the game, they're like, and then there's the kids that are there, they don't know what's going on exactly, they know they're playing in the peewee football game, yeah. But they're not sure, like, they're looking over at the coach always with their hand up, like, what do I do? That's my people.
Here's the thing, that was me, but here's the difference. I swear, I was watching UMS, might have been, they were getting ready for a game, they might have been fourth and fifth graders,
mm-hmm.
I swear they had seven coaches. I mean, they were barking instructions to these kids. You couldn't be confused on the field because
there were so many telling you what to do.
So many people telling you what to do. All right, we're not going to tell him what to do, but we appreciate that he's on with us right now, back from North Carolina. Pete Rehm joining us on the line. Pete, I didn't realize you were back, so welcome back. Glad you're back. What's the situation in North Carolina with your family and homes and everybody? What's going on up there?
Well, good morning, Dan, Sean. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I got back this weekend. I was up there. I went up last Sunday, drove in Monday morning. I got to Knoxville last Sunday, loaded up, got there, and I drove in Monday morning because I didn't want to go in the dark.
Yep.
I needed light. I was able to get in from Tennessee, from the Tennessee side over the mountain, and fortunately, which when you head that way, there was a big road closed sign, and but I saw people coming out, so I drove around it, but that was fine, so you were able to get in. And we have a cabin up there, which is only about 15 miles from the Tennessee line, and thankfully, my daughters and all the grandchildren, son-in-law, well, one son-in-law, was at the cabin, and they were fine, and I got to them Monday morning. Now, my oldest daughter lived in a place called Pensacola, North Carolina, across from Cattail Creek, which is normally 10 to 15 feet wide.
Mm-hmm.
That creek came out, and she's about 200 feet from the creek. Cattail Creek came out of its banks and completely washed away her house.
Wow.
There was over 8 feet of water in her house, trees going through it. They lost everything. Her house is completely gone. Half of it's gone, and the other half of it was knocked off the foundation and sits where the barn used to be. It's a 120-year-old farmhouse, just destroyed.
Jeez.
But thankfully, they were up at our cabin, and our cabin sits pretty high, so we didn't have a threat of flooding. And the way it kind of depends on, for all the people up there, where your house was on the hill, if there was a lot of hill or mountain above you, you had a lot of water coming down on top of you.
Right, I can imagine the runoff.
Yeah.
Yes, the runoff. That's what got my other daughter. Is she lived a mile above the North Toe River, and the mile below her, where you turn off the main road to go up to her house, my other daughter, it looks like anything you ever saw, like a Katrina in the Mississippi Gulf Coast. That little turnoff down there by the river. The buildings are all gone, flattened. I mean, bridges completely taken out. I mean, it was unbelievable. Then you go up the mile to her house. You know, the houses are still there, but there's mudslides that they don't usually have up there. Matter of fact, one of the hills slid off on Tuesday. We didn't realize it came down. It was so wet, it took a while for it to actually slide. But now her house, she was subject to what you talked about, Sean, the runoff. There's a lot of hill above her, and there was literally a mountain of water came down.
Mm.
Fortunately, the damage to the house was not severe, but it literally redirected a creek that's normally 50 feet away from the house, was redirected underneath the house.
Underneath the house?
That picture's unreal. Yeah, I was looking at Pete, I was looking at your pictures there this weekend, and y'all look at them. It just made a new channel, right, Pete? And it decided to go under the house.
It went under the house. But fortunately, we were able to dig a little trench and divert it back where it really wanted to go. It was just where everything was upset with sediment. It diverted it, and so more needs to be done, but we got that diverted. But it's stories like that. My ex-wife was actually a good example. She lives towards the top of the hill, so she didn't suffer any real damage from water or anything. But she has a 500-foot driveway that's almost straight up. Well, a huge oak tree fell across her driveway.
Wow.
Well, she can't do anything with that.
Right.
I mean, so that, as a matter of fact, I went with my son, and we didn't get there till Thursday. So she could only walk out. She couldn't drive out because the driveway was blocked, right?
Yeah.
But it took till Thursday before my son and I we had to go to John City to get a bigger chainsaw and cut this thing up, you know. And I have new respect for people who do that, because if you've never cut up a really big tree sitting across the road.
it's work, and the big trees like that, it can get spooky depending on, you know, how green that tree is. I mean, when you're cutting something that big.
No, I did a lot of pondering on where should I be standing or not standing.
Yeah. Here's the thing.
But those are examples of what everybody's dealing with. There's so many, and I was shocked how many old people live way up on hollers on the side of mountains and stuff, and they, you know, and they're not real able. They can't lift stuff. They can't get stuff. I mean, like, flushing water was a big deal, because without power, everybody's wells were out, except for some had reservoirs. If you had a reservoir above your house that had gravity, you were good. But if you had a well, you were screwed, and you had to carry flush. Well, there were so many older people. They can't go 100 to 1,000 feet down the driveway to the creek and tote buckets of water back up to the house.
8 pounds
the creek
a gallon,
flush.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, simple stuff like that had to be done.
You know, so these examples are certainly painting a picture, and all I'm thinking about right now is the countless stories like that. How many people are in real peril right now, maybe unaccounted for, or, like you said, it's older people who aren't well enough to, you know, they're not banking on something, this sort of tragedy happening in their little peaceful mountainside town. You know, they're just living out their life, and suddenly that life is threatened. And for some, I guess it actually ended because of the storm and the unavailability of people to help, volunteers to federal authorities, to Red Cross, to whatever. Did you see anything like that in terms of any resources that were coming in to help?
As far as resources,
mm-hmm.
The first few days we were there, the only thing we saw was the locals and volunteers, you know, and people like me. I mean, that one of the reasons my kids and grandkids were up there, so I headed in and I sort of followed. There was a guy on Facebook from Indiana who went in the day before me, and he was the same thing. You know, he had kids and grandkids there, and he was coming from Indiana, and he was posting on Facebook how he was going, and he and I went back and forth, you know, and he posted on Sunday as I was driving up, "Hey, I got through the way we discussed. I got through." You know, that's the people I saw the first few days. The volunteer fire departments were out. Churches were out. I mean, and neighbors, like, on the road where our cabin is, there's not even 10 houses, but I met all my neighbors because literally everybody came by and checked on everybody else. I never met them before, but everybody came up and said, "Hey, are you here? Is anybody here? Does anybody need help?" So neighbors, I saw a lot of that. I left Friday evening, and in the time I was there, we did not encounter really any federal or state officials.
Mm-hmm.
What we did finally see about Thursday was some military units started staging supplies at various schools around the county, which, now I tell you, that was much appreciated that they came with supplies. But by that time, the churches and volunteer fire departments were ready. You know, they had, and this was heartening too, they had organized, people were bringing them water and stuff. So if you needed something, you went to any church or volunteer fire department, they probably had diapers, they probably had water, and they would be grilling out there trying to cook hot meals. So the point I'm getting back to about the military getting there, so you had all these young, able-bodied military people, and they showed up to the schools, and they'd be unloading pallets of water and MREs and standing there ready to hand them out. And by this time, you know, everybody's running around, you know, people like me, too old and too dumb to be operating a chainsaw, are, you know, running around, and we're looking at them going, we don't, the old women are handing out water. We need them with equipment out here going up these driveways and helping people get out and clear stuff off the road. Because literally, in, now our cabin's pretty remote. In our area, nothing, the roads were cleared. And the week I was there, they were not cleared. There was only paths cut literally by the locals with their own chainsaws. Hmm. So we were, I mean, the day I left, I was still driving around the same fallen trees, the same downed power lines. This was Friday. I was still driving around in our area. Down in the population center, they were working from the outside, you know, the population center out. But it was literally the local people got out and cut enough of a path for vehicles to pass. And it was still, like I said, in our area that way Friday.
So you got there Tuesday. So you're talking about Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So in that time,
I got there Monday.
Monday, okay.
I was in Monday morning.
Okay. And so would you say that you saw a substantial change in the conditions or very little?
In our area, there was not substantial change in the conditions where the cabin is. Now, when I got back down to the main town, where we usually shop, called Burnsville, that's a population center. It makes sense. There was starting to be substantial change in the conditions. The power company was there. There was heavy, there was some heavy equipment coming in, some contractors, because there was a, thankfully, there was a couple of main bridges on the U.S. highway that runs through the town. They got to work. They had to put them down to one lane because they were about to fall in, and they were working on, so that stuff was working. But honestly, the supplies came from the people. Like, the Cajun Navy was set up at one of the shopping centers. There's like two little shopping areas, or actually three, but they're very small shopping areas in Burnsville, and one of them, that whole parking lot, Cajun Navy was set up. And if you can find their pictures, they had supplies just all over the place. I mean, you could get up there and get whatever you wanted. And they were organizing every day to go, who needs help? And I mean, Facebook actually had more coordination, from what I could see, than the county or anybody else. Because what we would see when you could get a signal, which was very hard, and thankfully, there, about 2 miles from our cabin was a volunteer fire department, and somebody had gotten them a Starlink so I could go up there and get, you know, a little bit of a signal and a call out or two.
Yeah, that was a guy named Elon.
But people were posting, would post on Facebook, a thing called Pernsville Hub, hey, so-and-so at this address and blah, blah, blah. And that would be related to either somebody like the Cajun Navy, or they had all sorts of people. I mean, literally, there were teams of people would show up from wherever, armed with, you know, bedrolls, chainsaws, gas tanks, water, and they would say, where do we need to go?
Yeah.
And if you could get them to somewhere, they would just go up and clear people's driveways. But that was individuals that I saw.
Thank God for people like that. And have you ever met the Cajun Navy?
They were on my show a couple times years ago. You know, you think about the negatives of social media, but what Pete's talking about too is social media could be a fantastic tool.
It was
in that situation. Pete, I want to also ask you about this story I was reading over the weekend. Y'all listen to this, and you're talking about divine providence and a story of grit here. You pointed out that while one of your daughters who lost the house, Jessica, she was safe. She evacuated and got safe. I guess your son-in-law stayed behind, and then when he went to evacuate, can you tell folks that story about how he did leave the house the next day and how he found your daughter?
That was just a divine providence, and my daughter, they had no communication. We couldn't talk to any of them either, right? So we had no idea what was going on. So the day after, so Friday when it hit, he stayed behind because they had chickens and a dog, and he was going to watch because they expected water to come up to the house and block the roads, but they didn't expect it to wash away the house.
Sure.
So he was down there watching. He realized it was coming up fast, and he was in his truck, and him and the dog backed up. There's a driveway next to their house that goes up to a house above them on the hill where he stayed that night, but he kept backing up the hill, and he just watched it all happen. Well, there's no communication. Nobody knows anything. So by Saturday morning, he wants to find, because he didn't know where his family is other than they're at our cabin, and are they okay? Because he didn't know what happened on the other side of the county.
Sure, yeah, that makes sense.
So there's no way to communicate, and the roads down there in Pensacola are totally washed out. You can't drive anywhere. Bridges are gone, totally washed out. So my son-in-law and the dog, it's normally a 15-mile drive to town over the windy roads, but he hiked over the mountain with the dog 8 miles.
Wow, up and over.
So he's going over straight over the mountain with him and the dog, hiked back to town 8 miles. My daughter, Saturday morning, not knowing where her husband is, can't hear anything. We're 15 miles by road to the north side of Burnsville in the cabin. So, but you can't get that way because the bridges are washed. So she hitchhikes 25 miles because she got to go through Spruce Pine. She got to go all the way around to the north and come back. And she hitchhikes 25 miles to get to town to find out if she can find her husband. And thankfully, thank the Lord, she literally was put, she arrived at the rescue station there at the center part of town. Well, where the main road coming out of Pensacola comes into town, there's a rescue station. She arrives there, and just shortly after she arrives there, he's walking out with the dog.
Oh, my gosh.
How about, when I read that, they gave me goosebumps, Pete. Oh. That's a heck of a story.
That is an amazing story. Yeah. Hey, Pete, we appreciate you sharing so much with us this morning, including
and Pete's
that
post
story.
Now shared on our Facebook page, too. So okay. If you want to see Pete's pictures, too, you can go to FM Talks Facebook page and link through there.
Thanks for doing what you did. I know you did it because of family, but I'm sure you helped a lot of people up there as well. And glad that everyone, for the most part, is okay, Pete. Thanks for your time this morning.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. Keep praying for those people. They got a long road to rebuild.
That's absolutely the picture that you're painting, for sure. Pete Ream on FM Talk 106.5 and Mobile Mornings. My gosh, that's a lifetime movie final chapter, right?
When I read that, I think it was Sunday, I said, holy cow, what a story.
8:53, Dan and Sean in for Dalton. What's going on, y'all? Dan, and thanks again to Sean Sullivan filling in for Dalton this morning. Greatly appreciated. Okay, we've got the Jeff Porch Show on the way. And his guest list includes Eastern Shore Republican Women's Judy Barlow. She's in the 9 o'clock hour, about 9:35. An hour from then will be U.S. Representative Gary Palmer on Jeff's show. And then to wrap things up, 11:35, AL GOP Chair John Wall. He's got a new position as well. It's got to do with the library board, right? Anyway, they'll talk libraries and they'll talk GOP politics in the state of Alabama, and they'll do that around 11:35 this morning. Thanks again for all the texts, phone calls. Thank you to Pete Ream for his account of what was going on in a place called Burnsville, North Carolina, in the Western Carolinas. Appreciate what he's done. Keep those people in your prayers and help them any way you can. 8:59, talk to you tomorrow.